This is John Batchelor. The show begins tonight in Moscow, asking questions about the attack on the Moscow theater by, we're told, Tajiks recruited in and around Moscow. The information is incomplete. Much fog of war. The video showing the four accused indicated that they were apprehended and roughed up by the Russian authorities. They now face a great deal of law in front of them. I'm keen on spending time with Bill Raggio and Hussein Akhani about what it means that the Tajiks were recruited in Moscow or near to Moscow. Tajikistan has been one of the Central Asian states most receptive to Russian authority. There are Russian bases in Tajikistan. It borders Afghanistan. ISIS-K is named as having taken responsibility. ISIS-K is a subset of Al-Qaeda. Bill Raggio tells me that the ISIS-K fighters he knows, several hundred, several thousand, it's unclear, probably are in the ungoverned space of Afghanistan, perhaps Tajikistan, but unlikely the Russians are there. There's much more to learn. This is a blow to those who believe that the war on terror was solved with the effort of the U.S. and NATO and others for these decades. It is not solved. ISIS-K is now recruiting on the basis of its success, the burning building on television, the panic. All of that feeds the narrative that ISIS-K is advancing. There's much more. Then the show turns to an essay by Peter Berkowitz, following the reporting of a new book that recommends combining the Reagan foreign policy with the Trump foreign policy, the Trump first administration foreign policy, of strength and peace building through deterrence. As Ronald Reagan said pithily once upon a time, we win, they lose. The man who prepares for war is the man who will find peace at the other end of his production. Michael Boskin joins tonight to make the similar point that the defense industrial base of the United States must be reawakened. And Brad Bowman of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies joins to say not only should the U.S. reawaken its defense industrial base, the ships, the arsenal of democracy, but also Israel needs to build one so that it's not dependent upon the generosity of allies or purchasing on the market. Israel can develop a defense industrial base that can sell to the world, a profit-making base, given that those factories and management teams will be under fire in the eventuality of a Hezbollah attack. That has to be taken into account. Nonetheless, defense industrial base. And then a conversation about the Shifa Hospital gun battle going on now with Malcolm Honlein and Thaddeus McCotter. There is much to discover about the Shifa Hospital, but 800 were detained according to the latest report, some of whom were not Hamas, but most all of were suspects. There's more going on because Malcolm tells me that the Hamas fighters reinvest the hospital once the IDF has moved on. It's a vast complex of 10 buildings with tunnels underneath, as we know. And then a conversation about Iran gun-running to the West Bank to build up for another attack phase. There is fresh information about that. Iran is the author of Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, and now the West Bank gunmen. And yet, right now, Iran sits apart from all of this, with its borders secure. And then a conversation about Hong Kong. The very bad news out of Hong Kong is that the people of Hong Kong are now crushed by a new security law passed unanimously by the Legislative Council that gives less freedom to speak or act or invest in Hong Kong than even on the mainland, according to Mark Simon, who knows he lived there a long time working as a director of Apple Daily, which is now closed by the security law. And then Rick Fisher reminds that the plans for the PRC on the moon includes an ability to dominate the high ground, militarize the moon, in other words, able to watch Earth and possibly interdict in Earth orbit. All this is science fiction, except that it's right in front of us. The determining factor is what is the lift capacity of the Russian and Chinese boosters. Rick estimates that they will not have a match for Super Heavy at Boca Chica for perhaps up to a 10 years, an operational match. However, to be revised later. And then a conversation about Mr. Putin and how he responded to the 9/11 attacks in 2001. Katrina Vandenhove recommends that the White House consider the president calling Mr. Putin and express sympathy for what's happened and ask if there's anything more can be done. Mr. Putin was keen on making that phone call 9/12 and signing the condolence book at the Moscow embassy. I believe it was the Moscow embassy. In any event, a gesture in that fashion doesn't cost anybody anything but a cup of tea and perhaps could start a dialogue about the unsolved Ukraine. Bill Raggio reminds that the Niger junta has now ordered the U.S. out of Niger. That's logical. They elbowed aside democracy. They're strongmen. They're leaving ECOWAS, or at least they want to, along with Mali, Burkina Faso, and Ghana. And so maintaining a drone base by the United States is inconsistent. Even if the drone base is supposed to be directed at al-Qaeda and jihadists, ISIS, in the neighborhood, they've been ordered out. And West Africa is no longer transparent. And then conversation with my good colleagues, Joseph Umar, about the trouble in Mexico caused by AMLO, saying that he wants, in order to secure the border, he wants $20 billion a year for the Americas and Caribbean from the U.S. He wants the embargo lifted on Cuba. He wants the sanctions lifted on Venezuela. And he wants Mexican citizens living in the United States without documents to get citizenship. Knowing that none of this is satisfiable, AMLO, according to the analysis by Joseph Umar, is making it very clear to everyone that the explanation by Venezuela about the poverty and famine and broken lives and the inadequate hospital care is because of the U.S. sanctions. Much the same excuse in Cuba, except for there's famine there because of the embargo. That's what AMLO is saying when he makes these demands. Ernesto Araújo joins to talk about the very, very troubled Brazil more than a year and a half after the election. Lula da Silva remains just about as unpopular as he is popular, and the country remains divided 50-50 between Lula da Silva and the disenfranchised. The disenfranchised Jair Bolsonaro, who cannot run for office again in the next cycle, who has had to surrender his passport and is now under investigation for plotting a coup and for falsifying his vaccine record. There's much more to the show. I hope you enjoy it. The world right now is deeply troubled. I'm John Batchelor.